following the Anabasinicus continued with prominence in Latin America, in Spain, Belgium, and with a residual influence in Africa, which I'll cover a bit later, which is not really spoken about. Africa and Asia, it's not really covered much in the history of the First International, and that's because there was officially dominated by a peasant working class. Essentially, the Marxists held a prejudice against the peasants in particular, claiming that they were ignorant and unable to proceed with a full revolution, a social revolution, and that was the task of the proletariat in their sense, understanding that as the industrial working class, blue-collar working class only. So concerning the developments of the anarchist current of the First International, particular emphasis are put on the fora. The fora basically were the oldest section that was the oldest section out of the anarchist current. And with the fora, basically, the idea and the formation of the fora was to form a general workers' association. So from the outset, the fora was reluctant to form any parties to compete for control within the organization. So they didn't form a dualism within the forerunner of what became the fora, the FOA. Regional Federation of Argentinian Workers went on to form a particularly interesting form of anarcho-syndicalism. There's three currents of anarcho-syndicalism, which is purely economic, which examples of that would be found in France, in early France, and it's based on the Charter of Amiens, and in Italy, where purely economic, so basically they weren't satisfied with any political dialogue within the organization, because for the greatest possible ability to attract workers and not have debate was their intention. What actually happened was by suppressing any political dialogue within the organization, within the broader workers' organization, what they actually did was depreciated the class's understanding of its own capabilities to take on political issues. So concerning the fora, which took a considerably different stance than this, they basically encouraged full dialogue on political subjects. So right from the start, they formed what we today call an integral anarcho-syndicalist model. So an integral model basically allows no political, not even a affinity group, investigative organizations such as the FAI, which was associated with the CNT in Spain. Between these two different models, the most well-known model is the CNT, which is quite unique because from the start, its main theorists were Ricardo Miller and Anselmo Lorenzo. Anselmo Lorenzo basically had argued that the CNT as a general organization must fight for libertarian communism, and that no specialist organization, which in the mid-20s the FAI was created, that there was no specialist anarchist organization within it up to that point. The CNT created what we today call the confederal model, basically organizing on a regional basis as well as an industrial basis. If you look at the statutes of the International Workers Association, the first point is that revolutionary unionism is based on the struggle of the working class directly against the capitalist, and the working class should be organized into industrial unions. This is considered, and still today, anarcho-syndicalists of all three different varieties consider this to be the the basis of that struggle is that workers are directly in contact, in struggle against the employer, and that this is the most fundamental in creating the a finalism, a struggle which can actually change society significantly enough that oppressive institutions can be destroyed and replaced with a new society. So although it might seem that an organization such as the USI, which didn't allow explicit political dialogue, although an organization such as them, although an organization such as the USI did reduce the explicit discussion of political issues, eventually within the USI it was able to create a significant enough anarchist current to argue for libertarian communism, basically, and it was mostly because the Communist Party's interest in trying to control that organization that it came about. So anarchist syndicalism isn't a homogeneous one single argument. It basically emerges from the direct struggle of workers in those various countries. And the coordination of that has generally been done since 1922 by the IWA, the International Workers' Association. Considering the IWA, basically, the administration of that was generally done, well, that administration was first in Germany and then passed on to Holland. Concerning the administration work of it, it's purely administrative. The secretariat of the IWA has no part in controlling the organization, which is the in the case of the First International, this is how that generalized organization had been, how they tried to control it. The Marxists, the IWA is based on the principal fundamentals of the anarchist syndicalism is rank and file control in the workplace. So all three models basically argue that all workers, whether they're part of the anarchist syndicalist organization or not, that all of the workers basically form an assembly, and within that assembly decisions are made concerning the interests of workers, and this is how they create the greatest possible solidarity. The internal model of economic organization is industrial unionism as opposed to trade unionism. Trade unionism ordinarily divides workers this often is used as a tool by bureaucrats to manipulate, well, to continue in their own interest. Concerning the fora, once again, when it comes to the issue of industrial unionism, they do apply industrial unionism within the fora, but so they do organize by industry, but they generally don't call these unions, they call them societies of resistance, which their view as, and also as an organization, they don't ordinarily call themselves anarchist syndicalists, they ordinarily call themselves an anarchist union or anarchist communist, which is essentially libertarian communism, the aim being a free and classless society. Today, the IWA the sections of the IWA are nowhere in comparison to what they were previously, mostly because the emergence of fascism, war had also taken up to the Second World War, and arguably the Spanish Revolution was the outset, the start of the Second World War, which was used as battleground really to test the political situation and the capabilities of military to suppress and destroy a revolutionary struggle. The CNT basically continued in the struggle for 72 years. Basically, 1936, Franco claims that there was a military coup and they wanted to take power of Spain, unsatisfied with the Republican government. Within the working class organizations, with the Republicans had taken control already of the government through the PSOE. There had been fabricated insurrection in Casas Viejas in 1933, and for the 3 years leading up to 1936, where the coup had started, basically in that time the workers had set up insurrections. 1934 in Asturias, the miners had an insurrection which was quite quickly suppressed. Although where these workers had set up it, or had gone out in insurrection, that the repression had actually where they had gone out in insurrection, their aim was to create actual physical libertarian communist society in those areas, which is to abolish money, to replace capitalism in the state with works councils. So they removed all of the authoritarian structures within the strongholds where libertarian communists were present. Concerning the anarcho-syndicalist participation in the Catalonian government. This is normally pointed out that the anarcho-syndicalists, the failure of the anarcho-syndicalists was not to actually, where they had strongholds, where they had the capabilities to create libertarian communism, to not go ahead and enforce that. The truth is that wherever they did have strongholds, they did enforce that. It was basically concerning the capitulation of the ministers, the four ministers. Also, another argument which is raised up against anarcho-syndicalism is that because those four were part of the anarcho-syndicalist organization, then unions would ordinarily always be co-opted into the state. But at the same time, these people were members of the FAI, which was the specific organization which emerged to fight parliamentary reformism within the CNT. The CNT within the IWA had come to recognize their error in that within the IWA as an international, there was a great deal of turmoil about this, particularly the CGTSR, the Syndicalist Revolutionary CGT in France, were critical of the CNT, of the participation. Within the CNT itself, there was a strong minority that opposed this, but it was actually a majority that felt, for tactical reasons, as a matter of expedience, that the CNT should participate in the Committee of Anti-Fascist Militias, which became that government. The CNT should participate in that mostly because they had poor arms and ammunition. That the CNT was outmaneuvered essentially when it came to the gold in Madrid, which was used to buy guns for the Stalinists, which grew very rapidly once they had the guns available to them. Today, anarcho-syndicalism is. Today, anarcho-syndicalism and most of the organizations across the world, you actually need to be an anarchist to join that organization. The only exceptions being the USI and Italy, which I believe they've got one non-anarchist member of a political party. In the case of a lot of the other sections in the IWA, you have what's might be considered, well basically you have different factions within those, not understood in the sense of Marxism where factions are opposing each other, but in terms of how a new society can be brought about. In the case of France, you have anarcho-syndicalists who insist on libertarian communism being the anarchism being the ideal of the membership, so revolutionary anarcho-syndicalism. Counter-communism is a minority within that as well. So essentially the difference between counter-communism and anarcho-syndicalism is that counter-communists don't necessarily concern themselves with explicitly referring to anarchism or explicitly referring to libertarian communism as their aim. What they want is basically to create a similar, or they want to create works councils the same as we do. They just, as far as anarchists are concerned, anarchists concern themselves with the fight against all oppression. So it's not specifically the workplace and the workplace alone, which is often criticized. Anarchism is often criticized for that, particularly anarcho-syndicalism. But we do fight against other forms of oppression as well, such as sexism, racism, homophobia, anything the bosses would want to use against us. And also, we would want the world to continue and not just get ruined by production process. Right. Just a few examples of our involvement as a group. My own group, Edinburgh Solidarity Federation. Edinburgh Council in 2006 basically started a process of trying to cut back on expenses. And when in this process, basically they brought out a lot of teachers and nurses on strike because, well, there was a dispute with teachers and nurses around the issue of they were wanting to pay off 40 workers. The teachers and nurses went out on pickets. They marched in the city, and as a group, we got involved in this at a later stage. After those pickets, we actually got to speak to workers when they were wanting to organise after a second round. The workers hadn't been sacked at that point. They'd returned after the strike because the bureaucrats had signed agreements. As far as our involvement with that particular fight is concerned, we encouraged the workers to organise assemblies, that all the workers could attend an assembly, set up an agenda at the assembly and work out a strategy to fight the council. We argued that they use direct action, direct struggle, and to force the council to back off. We had five meetings. The way that the meetings actually were held was every 2 weeks we would meet in a pre-organized place. There were delegates elected. The delegates basically were recallable. And so basically, as far as the council is concerned, the whole dispute had crumbled because the actual administration of what you call their early years education within the city, the actual administration had a parallel administration as well. Previously, it was each school which carried out its own decision on which children would go to that school, etc. So the head teacher would basically be in a fairly autonomous position to control how the school is run. What they did was they created a management system parallel to that, which is completely run by the council, which was to replace the head teacher system. So there was an internal conflict between the management, which we discovered that the new management system had a particularly high salary level. And that whole managerial system was actually collapsed because it became known publicly. So the council completely backed off, and at this stage there's no progress on that. The council is threatening their jobs. Is this thing working? But this is an example of some workers in Argentina. Some workers in Argentina that approached. Well, basically they approached the union, asked for it's a restaurant that they were working at. They approached the union, asked for representation and concerning the boss who was forcing them to work extra hours. Union basically wasn't able to do it. So this is just a demonstration, a recent demonstration which. I don't know if you can see it, it's very dark. This is, once again, this is Quora, but they're working with an organization called Libertad, which is a periodical. It's like, I suppose, Black Flag or Freedom. The thing is that the independent press is actually run by an organization. So Libertad is actually run by an organization of about 50 people. So it's basically Black Flag is run by that amount of people. So what their emphasis is on a really intensive analysis. So this was organized by them. They were able to, concerning this, and why I'm showing this particular one, is because the buses actually use, in Spain, the equivalent to this would be called pistoleros, which is basically people that are paid, the hired thugs, right? So basically the buses that hired there's a specific name in Argentina, that hired thugs basically to harass these workers that just got the reformist union in and to try and so basically what they were relying on is that these workers are isolated. After this demonstration, the boss completely backed off and the group actually joined Fora as well, which this is basically one point that where there's solidarity in the struggle, then workers would actually get involved. Wouldn't want, I don't think many organizations today would want to just, on account of being a fighting union, attracting people, because that basically puts you in a position of you're serving other people. The idea of anarchism, or particularly anarcho-syndicalism, is that workers go out, they fight on your own behalf, as well as support each other and have solidarity and struggle. In Spain, since 2000, there's been a series of strikes. The Tomares workers have basically gone out on strike. They got support from CNT. They joined CNT and they were able to win their struggle. Then, when they won, they actually went back to their employer and demanded more, because they had actually built up the confidence to do that. You know, so and that basically became a pattern. They joined, and now they actually are they're quite capable and organized in Seville, where they actually are working. They have a presence within their workplace. For us, for anarcho-syndicalists, this is a particularly important thing. I think that this is what one of the areas that makes anarcho-syndicalism quite unique in the libertarian movement, is that we are very particular about trying to get a presence in the workplace. It's not because work is more important than other aspects in life, but that is the key area where change can actually be made. Where you have strength and solidarity in the workplace is a significant change. And otherwise, basically, there's also the higher risk of getting sucked into a position where you're assimilating the position and the tactics and the approach of political parties, where you start mimicking and aping that mindset. I don't know how much time is it right if I just give one more example.
Yeah.
Right. What actually attracted me to the idea of anarcho-syndicalism when I was about 21 years old, I'd worked in a distribution industry in South Africa, in Johannesburg, with 73 workers in a separate section. At that time, it was just at the time of the transition in the country. So moving from a quasi-fascist system, from apartheid to representative democracy, a parliamentary democracy. So what actually happened was the young workers and the workers that were on part-time positions were separate from the older workers, normally black workers, who also were drivers. At the time when I took the job, I actually realized that there was quite a lot of tension in the area where the black workers were working. So after some time, I became friends with some of the workers and actually got an idea of the background of why there's that tension. 2 years before I started, there was basically an incident where two workers had died within a matter of a few months apart. They weren't able to increase their pay. They'd go on strike, and these were attrition strikes. It was basically strikes where you withdraw your labor, you don't get paid. There's no social security to cover you or any type of security, so you're relying on the goodwill of your comrades, people who still have jobs. These workers had basically gone out on strike because of the two workers that had died in car crashes, basically, because they'd been forced to work long hours, they had low salaries, they had families. They needed to get by, so they'd work as much overtime as they could. So having workers work as much overtime as they could, basically 14 hours behind the wheel, there's a really high risk of falling asleep while you're driving. And that happened within a few months to two people. There were also cases in the workplace where people had lost fingers on conveyor belts, stuff like that, with management completely unsympathetic. So basically, there was a strike, a particularly aggressive strike, where the bosses had basically paid a thug, similar to the thugs around these guys. Bosses had actually paid a thug to go to one of the union organizers' house, and they burnt his house down with him and his child in the house. So the intensity, people say, the class struggle, fighting, workers fighting, that it can only reach a point. But the fact is that in some places, and depending on how this manifests itself, is particularly militant. In response to that, there were 70 workers that blocked off the two main cities of the country and had pitched battles for half a day with the police. They were joined by other truck drivers and so just to give you an idea, that's how tense it was. When I started out, I basically distributed a few anarchist journals, and workers within that hub the drivers had basically taken an interest in the ideas of anarchism. They had a tradition of working within their union, so they weren't willing to form an assembly right off and start to unite all the workers in the whole factory. We went ahead and did that. So a dispute had happened because a worker had lost three fingers. When I was there, he had three fingers cut off, and basically he'd been paid out a certain amount, a standard amount for each finger that was cut off, and depending on how many segments of the finger had been cut off. Another major change is because of the transition, a new law had been introduced which was forced by the Union Federation, COSATU, that any workplace with more than 70 workers has to have a union. And if it doesn't have a union, then the employers need to create a union for those workers. Now, technically, the department that we were working on was separate from the drivers. So the bosses had set up, they wanted to set up a bosses union. So they requested that the bosses basically said we need to vote for delegates, for representatives. So what happened was at that time there was a group of 17 workers that were interested, an actual physical group across the whole workplace. There were 73 workers on the one side and 70 on the other. So what we did was we basically, when they said we need to elect representatives, we basically wrote out that and told them that the rep doesn't want to be the rep, that we'll have an assembly. Every 2 weeks we'll meet on the shop floor after work, and we'll go ahead with clarifying what our demands are, and pass that to the employer. The bosses were really annoyed by this because they couldn't isolate who the union guy is or the union woman is. That they could basically control. That they could co-opt into making agreements behind closed doors. So the bosses were particularly annoyed with this, and like I said, there was a lot of tension in the workplace. So what we went on to do was continue with the assemblies. We called on what the employers would do is just basically shut down the fans to save money in a workplace with a lot of trucks. We called on them to stop that. We called on them to increase the pay. We asked them to go through formal procedures to request overtime, because overtime is life-threatening in that job. We'd actually developed our demands out of assembly. We were only able to have a few assemblies because the company, basically the management, were so concerned they flew the CEO over from the city, which is I think it's 900 kilometers away from where we were. So they flew him up immediately after the first assembly, and the company was moved 35 kilometers away. So they actually shut down the company. Ironically, now that company is called Union Transport. That same building is called Union Transport, and it's actually run by the union bureaucrats that were there when we had the big fight. And our fight was nothing in comparison to what happened 2 years before. So just to give you an idea, that's what interested me in anarcho-syndicalism. Why, for me, the task of organization, the task of creating a capacity and a willingness to change the society, to create a free and classless society, has to be anarcho-syndicalism, because it's the only form of organization that actually has confidence in workers. We don't separate the workers from the party. or the specific group, or whatever you want to call it. We demand that workers organize themselves. We form assemblies to protect them, to protect the workers' ability to make decisions openly. That's how we see libertarian communism. That's how we see anarchism. And anarcho-syndicalism, although there are strengths and weaknesses and that will make errors in places, in Spain we made a chronic error and we paid for it with our own lives. The thing is that anarcho-syndicalism will continue to fight, and basically our argument is that we will not separate the ability to decide. We won't separate manual work from brain work. We won't separate that within the class. And that's what makes anarcho-syndicalism unique. Has anybody got any questions?
In establishing an anarcho-syndicalist union or confidence, whatever, in the streets, would it begin by, say if you take a company like Coca-Cola, and there was this intent in, say, different factories in one country, would, in an attempt to build an anarcho-syndicalist sort of momentum going, would it start within, say, one building and one region, and then try and spread the communication to the next one, or would it start from like a, say, IWA?
Yeah.
And would they sort of try and approach or?
It's a very important point. We're internationalists. We don't believe that we can create an isolated revolution and that would spread. We have to have a worldwide revolution.
And where would it source from?
Well, have it for example, concerning tactics, this is another important thing about having an assembly. An assembly is not necessarily our responsibility is to call for revolution. That's the responsibility of the anarcho-syndicalist. And to defend free structures of workers. That's our responsibility. But the assembly itself can negotiate with the employer, can make those reforms. So, this is my view on it. There are a couple of different answers you could get to this question. So concerning organization, although capitalism has created its own misery, its own form of misery, it's also created the conditions for us to be able to organize it. And we should be aware of our capabilities, of how far we can organize and how far we can create a consciousness of a new society. But the difficulties and the contradictions are that fascism has emerged specifically to crush workers' organizations such as ours because of its ability to spread. So this is one of the reasons why quite a few anarcho-syndicalists are not that keen on the approach of constantly having demonstrations, constantly being in the public domain, in the public eye, because this can lead to employers basically creating an offensive which crushes right from the start. The federalism of anarcho-syndicalism as well. In a country like Colombia, to organize, even if you're organizing a reformist union, your life is under threat. In Iran, the same thing. In countries like that, or in countries where political religious extremism is so it's all different forms of oppressive structures, not only fascism as we might know historically. In countries like that, basically what we can do is provide support. We can offer solidarity and does this help to answer your question?
Let's just say CNT, did they start by the IWA, sort of in different regions getting together and going back into these regions and spreading anarcho-syndicalism in certain industries? Or would the anarcho-syndicalism rise in one industry in one region and then sort of
alright, you mean what would happen if it gets stuck in one industry?
Yeah.
And
how does it begin?
When I say confederation or confederalism, the understanding of the organization, particularly with the CNT, is that the organization is geographical as well as industrial. So and we apply the same thing in Salford as well, where your local group would basically unite people with the same ideas within the region. One of the responsibilities, the principal responsibility of that local group would be to create a presence within the workplace, an industrial presence, which essentially as time passes, if you look historically at the CNT, what it had done was it created a federation of local federations and a federation of industrial federations. And those two forms of organization, because essentially when you're talking about a federation of local federations, you're talking about what historically might be equal to a commune. And when you talk about a federation of industrial organizations, what you're talking about is equivalent or similar to one big union or a general industrial union. So in terms of economic struggle, minus the anarchism, and it's quite similar, and you can see where the link is with IWW, for example, who were the first, historically, they were the first to call for one big union. So we can identify that was a contribution of theirs. So, yeah, does that help to explain?
Yeah.
We organize on two fronts, economic and social. I mean, social, we actually mean, and the local is more capable of creating an environment. In Spain, they call them ateneos, which are basically a local for workers to go and discuss their ideas, their more detailed ideas on the issue of social revolution, on the issue of organization, on issues of patriarchy, so you can actually organize that type of environment.
So I just want to know, say in Ireland or today in Scotland, anywhere around, where you could start from if you want to develop a solution, to start within the workplace.
That's really difficult. Where it starts, I think the idea of where it starts is you form a group and try to spread that so that a second group you form and basically move beyond and move along that way. And at the same time, what you need to do is create a sympathetic periphery. Which would strengthen anarchism and weaken whatever form of statism might exist or reformism might exist in other organizations. Because essentially what we're wanting is the least conflict within the working class, the least conflict when we've got no illusions. The social revolution will mean destruction. It does have its own form of destruction. But that's in order to create a far better world.
And as a tactics, saying you're alone in your working place, would you join a kind of trade union and start to spread, or just be critic and not judge them and critique them from outside, because it's always
as far as we're concerned, we basically say that you can join if you want to. You can join a TUC union or an STUC union or a reformist social partnership union, but we've got no illusions that the unions can be made revolutionary. We've got no illusions about that. We basically argue, like in the case of when I was working in Edinburgh in an internet cafe, we were all given different shifts at different times, and we were seriously divided. The boss never told us about holiday pay and stuff like that. So what we did was we did arrange an assembly so that on a regular basis, every fortnight, so we're able to at least have the bread and butter issues. And that also helps you to be able to get an idea. It might be that you're in a workplace. I previously worked in a workplace where the union was actually controlled by fascists, and a lot of the members were fascists. So and at the same time, it had a very militant anti-fascist union in the same workplace. So obviously, if I had a standardized international centralist strategy of just saying, you join the union, that's just something I can't do, you know. Yeah, I can't just join, well, in this case it was a
non-union.
So just concerning that, our approach is, if you're working in a casual job, you're most likely going to need to rely on an assembly. If there's a reformist union and there's any use in it, then we definitely don't argue that you leave the union, because that's essentially your choice. If you are in the union, then we oppose paid positions. We oppose officials of all types.
I know about the French TNT, what is TNT AAT,
uh-huh.
It's really losing all about outrageous dogmatic seeing it as a French scene.
Yeah.
Our approach.
At the moment, we see real growth coming from expanding locals, because we can attract people. With today's technology, it's very easy to attract people just on your ideas, the strength of your ideas. The point is keeping contact, having a practical contact, and moving on from there. So, and also, there's a lot of myths about anarcho-syndicalism as well. Because we actually do hold politics and do actually have strategies, and that this is federalist, so it's based on the experience of workers. A lot of our ideas are misrepresented. I'm not saying that your experience is that you're wrong and the CNT AIT is not dogmatic, because they're very militant. And I think, well, my honest answer to your question was concerning the CNT AIT. I still need to figure out some of the stuff that's happening there. But, does that help answer? But we've actually got three approaches. If there's a union and you're in the union, you fight for anarcho-syndicalism in the union. So that needs to be done tactfully. You'd argue for workers' control of the union. So the very basic principles, workers' control of the union. So you'd be arguing for federalism, that it's and also you'd be holding them accountable. Be arguing that the reps basically function as delegates, and that they're recallable. This is where the difficulty is that these unions are so large and so entrenched in their own partnership with their employers that success in that is quite difficult. But when you're involved and you're actually putting forward those arguments, what you are likely to do is you're likely to get a lot of workers within your who hear what you're doing and you could form a stronger position that way.
So a good basis for building an anarcho-syndicalist union would be, obviously you go into a trade union, then you if your sphere of influence, the ones who are at the worst end of the bureaucracy, you know, you have a weird views, perhaps you're going to split from the union, you know?
We have done that in Bristol. We were contacted by workers who were casual workers, right? And they'd taken up full-time positions, and most of them had joined Unison. So basically, in the disputes that they'd had with their employers, they'd basically broken away and formed a small independent union, which functioned as a union. It took all of the roles, all of the responsibilities of the union, of a union, and they were satisfied to recognize themselves as a union. But they eventually registered in it. So
it's developed.
Well,
just. If you want to conclude by anything.
Okay, alright. Concerning them, they they are still, what actually happened was they didn't rename, they broke away, they applied for listing, and then with their isolation they decided to rejoin in order to spread their ideas. So they're still now actually, well, they've gone back in, but that just shows that they, just by I'm not saying practice is enough. You have to have the ideas that go with it. You have to have a consciousness that that bread and butter issues are important, but they're not enough in a struggle. So that they had rejoined, but the whole thing did create a lot of alarm, and it's not surprising that the bureaucrats were basically using every excuse that they could to try and manipulate the scenario in their favour.
Thank you.